PC man and pioneering PC game developer, Greg Cooperberg. Part 1. The Spark and a Pac-Man Clone. I think a lot about the spark these days, that being the ignition, the jolt, the wake-up call, the thing that first made me interested in video games and computers back in the 1970s when I was a kid, the thing that made me believe computer programming was not just a cool thing, but the only thing I ever wanted to pursue. I wonder if the spark has been extinguished for kids in the 21st century. With so many cynical ways technology has been twisted into service in 2025, I wonder if anyone could possibly be inspired by it. Or is the constant hum of technology now just another static pulse added to the background noise of a world seemingly drowning in the technology that once promised to save it? The early wake-up call for me was the one that I felt when I first saw a program running on an Apple II computer in 1980, then permanently ignited when I got an Atari 800 computer a few years later. Back then, the idea of programming a computer lit my brain on fire, and that fire was fueled by playing tons of computer games. I visit those systems and games on a regular basis these days, through vintage computing, emulation, and sometimes venturing to places I've never been before. Recently, I've been looking at the early Wild West of PC XT 8088 games from 1981 and 1982. Some of the same ones I experienced on my friend Wesley's PC XT clone at his house in the early 80s. A few days ago, I was doing some final research for a long-suffering story about the 1982 PC game Executive Suite, when I came across another game from 1982 named PC-Man. Before I loaded the game, I was expecting what I found from a pile of other 1982-era Pac-Man clones for the IBM PC. Amusing character graphics that showed promise, but also highlighted the limitations of IBM's first personal computer platform. But when I played PC-Man, not to be confused with PC-Man No Dash, another cute Pac-Man clone that fell a bit short for my taste, I was surprised by its high-quality presentation and play. Maybe it was because I'd seen so many duds that day, but PC-Man seriously blew my mind as soon as I experienced it. In some ways, it looked better than even Atari's own 1982 release Pac-Man for their 8-bit computer line. The title screen shows a nice bitmap logo for the game, copyright 1982 Orion Software, with the name of the creator, Greg Cooperberg. I noted these names and started the game. Unlike other early Pac-Man games I played that day, this one felt like an actual arcade game, like the person who made it spent some real quality time feeding quarters into arcade games in 1982 and understood the nuances of the age. I played two entire games, trying to finish a full maze, but was never able to do it. Still, I was impressed. I love old PC and PC DOS games, but this one stood out, especially for the year it was released, 1982. I tried to put my mind back to 1982 and think about how this game would have been received. With very few other commercial quality games to play on a $2,000 computer setup, this must have been like an illicit joy to watch boot up on an IBM PC. What better way to recover from a long session of VisiCalc or DBase than with a Pac-Man style game you otherwise should not be playing on your serious computer? Maybe those same IBM PC owners, or maybe their kids, saw Atari's Pac-Man for the 8-bit computer line on display at a store and wondered why their computer, that cost three times as much, seemingly could not produce the most basic versions of arcade games while Atari ate them for breakfast. Of course, the Atari 800 had been designed at start to play great games, but not so the IBM PC XT. In fact, the IBM was seemingly designed to do everything but play games. However, programmer Greg Cooperberg found the IBM PC to be a sort of tabula rasa that could be manipulated in any way he wanted. Quote, "At the hardware level, the IBM PC impressed me as a fairly clean computer that can, in principle, do anything. But it is true that out of the box, it had very little software support for games. It's also true that it had limited colors and that audio support was limited and bad." Then sometime in 1982, PC-Man arrived at Computerland, or whatever the local PC store was called, and maybe it was like an illicit revelation. Maybe in some ways it validated the purchase of their computer. The next thing I imagine is people booting up PC-Man over and over and seeing the name Greg Cooperberg on the title screen. And I imagine in their mind, he and Orion Software became a bit legendary. Who was this guy in this company that made their 1982 IBM PC XT feel like an arcade machine playing Pac-Man? At the same time, PC-Man is not an exact copy. The game is obviously Pac-Man, of course, but with a figurative and literal twist. The maze in PC-Man is rotated 90 degrees, and the ghosts are not the authentic colors due to four-color CGA mode limitations. But other than that, it's spectacular and also very difficult. In fact, even though the colors are not correct, the use of color is awesome, using a technique apparently called ordered subpixel dithering, a way of faking extra colors by carefully arranging pixels to create more colors than should be possible in CGA. The game is written in machine language, assembly language, and while it's no surprise that it plays better than games written in BASIC in 1981 and 1982, it also stands right alongside and sometimes above even the best games from other machine language developers of the era. Playing PC-Man sent me into a rabbit hole of sorts. I wanted to find out who Greg Cooperberg was and what other games he may have made for Orion Software. If games like PC-Man were the spark for a kid like me back in the 80s, I wondered, what was the spark for the guy who wrote it? PC-Man is not the only decent machine language PC XT game that came out in the 1981-1982 timeframe. There were others. Games like ABM from David Disk, a decent Missile Command clone, or Albert Savoia's fun little arcade shooter Bitbat from Hagen Corporation, or Michael Abrash's Cosmic Crusader from Funtastic Inc., and also Snack Attack 2, also from Funtastic, by Dan Ilowski and also Michael Abrash. And still other games came from established game companies who had made their mark previously on the Apple and Atari platforms, like Olaf Lubeck's Apple Panic from Broderbund, Jay Sullivan and Frank Randick's Crossfire from Online Systems, Bruce Artwick's Night Mission Pinball from Sublogic, and Harold Hadelman's conversion of David Snyder's Serpentine. All of these games and more deserve their own individual spotlights, especially Abrash Ilowski's fantastic games, but to me, out of all of them, PC-Man stands taller. In 1982, my friend Wesley was on a permanent quest to find a decent game for his dad's $2,000 IBM compatible. The game that was the ignition for us on that machine was Microsoft Decathlon. It's a game we played so much we nearly broke his dad's keyboard trying to do well in the events. Decathlon was indicative of the type of games I associated with the IBM PC. In an era when fast action arcade games were still the hottest ticket around, PC games had a flair of the serious about them. I mean, what could be more serious than trying to win a gold medal for the USA right smack in the middle of the Cold War? We spent weeks being obsessed with Microsoft Decathlon, but to be honest, what we really wanted was a fast action arcade game like PC-Man. Part 2, A Teenager in Auburn. It turned out my rabbit hole of research was not as deep as I imagined, as Greg Cooperberg had his own Wikipedia page. Reading the page, I gleaned this information. Greg Cooperberg was the child of mathematician parents born in 1967. He created three games for the IBM PC and then enrolled in Harvard in 1983. He went on to receive a PhD in geometric topology and quantum algebra and is now a professor at UC Davis. Very impressive. I'm not so great at math myself, but even I can do the simple arithmetic required to come to this revelation. Cooperberg was only 15 years old when he made these amazing arcade games, and he went to Harvard at 16. But in fact, as I'd find out later, he was much younger when he started programming. There was very little else about the games in Wikipedia, but there was a link to more information in a story on Ernst Krogroff's amazing website, Retro365. If you've never visited, Ernst, who was born in 1979, grew up playing all of his dad's computers. He has created an impeccably designed archival quality website dedicated to early computer games of the 80s and 90s. In the Wikipedia-linked article titled The Original IBM PC and Orion Software from September 23, 2019, Ernst wrote of Orion Software's origins like this. Orion was founded in 1980 by Kevin Azus while he was still in college. The company, operating out of Auburn, Alabama, would focus on entertainment software for the Apple II and IBM PC computers. Ernst goes on to describe one of Orion's first games as Paratrooper. According to Ernst, Paratrooper was based on an Apple II game named Sabotage by Mark Allen for Online Systems, who later became Sierra Online, and released in 1982. And Paratrooper was programmed by Greg Cooperberg. Next came PC Dashman, also 1982, and then there was a third and final game credited to Cooperberg, Jaybird, released in 1983, a clone of Q-Bird. I found Paratrooper in my own personal PC game archive and booted it up. It was a great little action game in the vein of Missile Command, released the same year as PC Dashman. It piqued my interest. One good game, well, that could be an anomaly. Two good games, both out in 1982? That had the makings of a dynasty. Then I tried Jaybird from my 1983 folder. It was impressive. It was as good or better than the other two. Three good games in the span of 18 months or so? Was that the sign of an auteur in the making? It made me wonder, what possessed Greg Cooperberg to make these games, and more importantly, what made him stop? This is the end of any information I could find about Greg Cooperberg and Orion Software. There is no interview with Cooperberg that I could find online, so I screwed up my courage and reached out to him via email, expecting no response. I couldn't even talk to my professors when I was attending college, and trying to talk to one now, even 35 years later, puts me right back in that same headspace. Cooperberg has some serious qualifications. He graduated from Harvard and Berkeley and was a top 10 ranked undergraduate mathematician in the 1986 Putnam Mathematical Competition and is now a fellow at the American Mathematical Society. I actually felt kind of bad emailing him because I was asking about such a minor part of his life before 1984, after which he had so many great and important achievements. I had the feeling, like some other people from the era that I've reached out to, that he would never get back to me. Part 3, Four Colors and a Boot Sector. I was surprised, though, that after a day, Professor Cooperberg enthusiastically responded to my email. We sent several messages back and forth, and he was delightful to converse with. You will find the complete interview at the link in the show notes. According to Greg, this is how he got started making games for Kevin Azus at Orion Software. Quote, I was 14 when my dad's former calc student invited me to work for his new company, Orion Software. It's true that Orion Software was basically just two people at first, but I was just a programmer in high school, and I wasn't any businessman who starts companies. It was really his company. At first, I worked on an IBM PC in this guy's house, and later, my family had an IBM PC that I used at home. I wrote those three PC games when I was 14 and 15. Again, one of Orion's first games was Paratrooper. Playing Paratrooper is quite an experience. For a first game, it has the feel of a polished arcade title from a seasoned veteran. Even the controls, which could have been a mess using the keyboard, feel right. While the game is almost identical to Sabotage, it has its own character as well. While Cooperberg uses simulators to write his games, there is more to his work that made them so playable. He basically bypassed almost all system graphics calls because he found them incredibly inefficient. Professor Cooperberg, quote, In Paratrooper, I remember that I used the system graphics functions only to draw the bullet from the gun. The rest was me writing directly to the screen display section of computer memory. I was disgusted to learn that this one tiny system graphic call was almost as slow as the entire rest of the screen animation in Paratrooper. After that, I avoided all the system graphics functions entirely. You can feel this while playing PC Dash Man. It contains a smoothness to the gameplay that is just not present in any but the best games that were released in 1982 for the IBM PC, for example, Snack Attack 2. It also feels like Pac-Man, maybe a bit too much, but 1982 was a time when the subject of intellectual property and computer games was still a gray area. Some of the changes Cooperberg made were merely functional ways to adapt the experience to the IBM PC platform. Greg, quote, "One key reason I rotated the maze in PC Dash Man is simply that a PC screen is wider than it is tall. I remember struggling with that issue when I came up with that solution." PC Dash Man was a hit. For now on, I'm just going to call it PC Man. We've had enough of PC Dash Man. PC Man was a hit. I personally have a distinct memory of seeing it on the shelves at Computerland here in Southern California, a long way from its starting point in Auburn, Alabama. Greg Cooperberg again. It was marketed nationally through computer stores that sold IBM PCs and software for them, stores like Computerland. Each game had basically one sales wave in the years that Orion software existed. Cooperberg's final game for Orion and for the IBM PC was Jaybird, a game distinctly based on another arcade title. It's very close to the most exacting recreation I can imagine being produced at the time. Greg, I was very impressed with Cubert at the time, but no, I didn't set out to recreate every possible nuance. Again, I was only a bit original, and I wish that I had been more original. Just in general, I thought of coin-operated video games as the big leagues, which they were. These were adult programmers with careers at well-established companies, and they had team support. I didn't set out to top them, I just respected them. But I did want to do professional-grade work, at least as a one-person show. I remember seeing some terrible PC games that were written very naively, I suspect by teenagers or college students, and I wanted to stand out from them. Some of Greg's Cooper games were written as assembly-language PC booter discs, standalone discs that booted straight into the game, no DOS needed. They did not need DOS and could get as close to the machine hardware as possible, which was obviously necessary to get such a beautiful game out of the IBM PC XT's hardware, which again was never designed to even smell a game, much less play one. Cooperberg described his development process like this. Believe it or not, they were all written in assembly language, and I mainly used a line editor called Edlin. I discovered that the IBM system graphics support was very slow, so my assembly language programs wrote image data straight into the section of the computer memory tied to screen display. And how did Cooperberg get such amazingly fluid animation when most of all the contemporary games struggled to get any graphics on the screen at all? Well, that was down to math and science. I cared about consistent laws of motion. When graphics fell, they traveled along parabolas. Instead of using CPU effort to pace the games, the animations were clocked to a fixed rate. I thought of proper game animation as analogous to movie frames. This is the single biggest reason my games played so smoothly. I also test played the games until they seemed fun. So these were some basic professional touches that were important to me, but many self-taught game developers back then didn't think them through. I learned through math and science that I was going to care about basics like that. And it's not just me in hindsight that thinks Cooperberg's games had the mark of excellence. In the 80s, Jaybird was used by professional adults to test and benchmark their hardware. Greg Cooperberg again. My proudest moment came when I read a report about one of my games from a team at Olivetti. They were testing the compatibility of an IBM PC under development. The Olivetti people knew that Jaybird was demanding regarding compatibility, and they found out that the boot sector was the whole reason. The boot sector was bad on purpose to make it harder to pirate the game. It was written by my friend Kevin Nomura, who I met at summer camp in Chicago, and who later worked briefly at Orion Software. Cooperberg, it was not the benchmarking that made him the proudest. It was the fact that these adult engineers, the type that he saw as in the big leagues making arcade games, viewed this code from a 15-year-old kid and were impressed by it. Greg, Olivetti reverse engineered the whole code, and they wrote that it was well organized and that I had done a good job. In the long run, I was as happy about that as I was about the sales or watching people play my games. While the technical prowess of Cooperberg's games set them apart from most of his contemporary competition, the one aspect that holds them back from being truly the work of a visionary auteur is fairly obvious. None of them are original games. They all include original elements, but are still adaptations of other source material. This is something Greg readily admits. If I had had a mature view of the whole issue of originality, then the games would have looked very different. Even so, I obviously did make some changes to make them a little bit original. Part 4, From Arcade Dreams to Mathematics. As it turned out, making games for the IBM PC was a short and very memorable time in Cooper Burke's life. Greg, I wrote 3 games in about a year and a half. Each one took several months, and there were breaks in between in the order of months. After which, Cooper Burke started college at Harvard University and never looked back. Well, almost never. Greg Cooper Burke. In my junior year of college, I wrote a Macintosh applet called Timeout, which, as usual, was an imitation of another game, in that case, the home Atari game Breakout. That one was written in C++ and used the Mac OS environment. By then, I was done with assembly language. I marketed it myself as $2 shareware. It did well enough, although it didn't make any fortune, which didn't bother me all that much. Like many desktop applets then, it was deliberately a minimalist effort. Science and academia then were Cooper Burke's future, not games. Greg, it eventually became clear that my real love is research and mathematics. I've done some other programming since college, although not games and not as its own paying job. And then what became of Orion Software? Greg, the president had big dreams to become a successful businessman. Orion Software had some later projects that involved several programmers, but the company fell apart, so he moved away and started other companies. He rolled the dice several times more while I went my own way. I majored in math and then went to math graduate school, and obviously that became my career. So how does Cooper Burke contextualize those few short, heady years in the early 80s as a prolific computer game programmer on the IBM PC as compared to his latter work in mathematics? Greg, for me, game development was like summers of fun with high school friends, while my research record as a mathematician has become more like marrying the love of my life. If I could not have become a math professor at a research university, there is a high chance I would now be a software developer of some kind. Not necessarily games. For example, I was also very interested in computer graphics, and I even went to SciGraph twice when I was an undergraduate. It's obvious to me that the best arcade games from 1981 and 1982 were written in assembly language. While my first job out of college had me working in 83-86 assembly, it was on such a large-scale system I never really got a handle on building directly for the machine itself. This got me thinking, what would it take to build something simple on a PC to display CGA graphics in assembly code? It took me quite some time to figure out how to do anything. It turns out I recalled near zero assembly code from 30 years ago. I worked through some examples from a book I found on archive.org, PC Assembly Language Step by Step. I made the speaker beep, I made an ASCII organ, and then I found a blog that showed me how to print Hello World on the screen, and some lessons in CGA programming. Finally, I got the machine to print Hello World on a 320 by 200 CGA display. I finished up by cobbling together enough code from examples and a whole lot of trial and error to move a mangled CGA Atari Fuji logo with the keyboard around the screen. It was a fun day getting familiar with 8088 assembly language, but it also proved to me just how difficult it would have been to create any kind of working game this way, especially in 1982 with almost no resources at someone's disposal, and especially if we're a 15-year-old in Auburn, Alabama, working in IBM CGA graphics mode. For color me dutifully impressed. I asked Jamie Landino, author of Starflight, which is about early DOS games, what he thought of Greg Cooper Burke's work. This is what Landino said. I have played many PC booter games, but it's clear Paratrooper, PC Man, and Jaybird are on another level with their smooth animation and responsive controls. They were among the few early DOS titles that could go toe-to-toe with anything on the more gaming-focused home computers of the day, like the Atari 800 and the Commodore 64. To this day, I have massive respect and appreciation for anyone who learned to program in assembly language. You could really see the difference. And to learn about the care Cooper Burke took with the screen refresh rate and system clock, it's the same kind of programming wizardry we've seen from more well-known industry pioneers. All 3 of his DOS games are genuinely fun to play, even right now. This leads me back to my idea of the auteur, What would define a computer auteur in an age when the canvas was so comparatively small and limited? Was Greg Kuberberg an auteur, or was he just a great technician? If my definition requires wholly original game mechanics, maybe not. But what if what I'm looking for is a distinctive way of thinking about games, timing, physics, craft, respect for the form? Then, Kuberberg's three games absolutely bear the signature of a pioneer, if not an auteur. Part 5, Searching for the Spark in the Modern World. So how did this 15-year-old game developer get started programming? Greg, my parents are math professors, now retired, and I was enthusiastic about mathematics from a young age. I first discovered computer programming at the local university computer center, and I liked it for much the same reasons I liked math. Kuberberg made his first mark when he was 12 years old, taking college-level calculus classes at Auburn University. He was even featured in a newspaper article in the Gadsden Times, January 27, 1980. For some reason, I'm struck by this picture. Kuberberg looks so young, yet so confident. The portrait of a kid genius, who by all measures, lived up to his potential. This leads me back now to how I started this quest, looking for what I refer to as the spark. So what might have been this for Professor Greg Kuberberg? What was it that at this age got him so excited about the future and technology? Well, in his case, it was simple, mathematics. Greg again. I remember being thrilled with solving conceptual math problems when I was 7. At that time, I was not very good at constructing proofs, but I remember that I was interested and had gotten started. Before that, although I do not remember it, my dad would give me arithmetic problems to solve on car trips. Then, like many of us from that age, Kuberberg discovered the basic language. Greg. I was 10 or 11 when I started programming. An older friend invited me to the Auburn University Student Computer Center, where I think they had an HP mainframe and later a DEC mainframe. Again, it was the first year and I was not very good, but I had gotten started. At first it was in BASIC, as it was for most children then. And then to arcade video games. Greg, I spent more time at the video game arcade than I should have from middle school to college at random times of the day, maybe usually in the afternoon. I mostly did computer programming during the day, on days when I wasn't at the arcade and wasn't busy with homework, etc. And finally, he made the next jump, the one that separated the enthusiasts from the hardcore and early machines, to 8088 assembly language. And he made his three games for Orion Software. So in 2025, in an era of cynical tech companies and AI bubbles, what does Kuberberg, who interacts with students on a daily basis, think could be the jolt, the ignition, the wake-up call, the spark for the next generation? Greg, what BASIC did for me, Python did for my children, and still does for many children and college students. Python. I personally cannot agree more, but with a strong caveat, Professor Greg Kuberberg again. What I think is a shame, and this was a trend long before the AI revolution, is that good apps for writing BASIC and Python became hard to find, unless you already knew that you were interested. What was there for everyone in the IBM PC became obscure. And this point is a good one. No one had to push kids like Kuberberg to want to learn BASIC code when he was 10 years old. There were no coding boot camps or STEM immersion or U-code storefronts with paid lessons in Minecraft Redstone and Roblox game development. Instead, there was just exploration and an eagerness to learn. And right there on the desktop of most every home computer was a copy of BASIC, waiting for kids to stumble onto it and be sparked into a life in technology, science, and math. Kuberberg himself never felt pushed into math, but simply immersed. Greg, my parents were mathematicians. They never pushed me into any of this, but they had a huge positive influence. Think of it as similar to skiing. Say, obviously, if you live in the Colorado Mountains and your parents are skiers, you're much more likely to get good at it at an early age. And the spark, well, that was something he shared with his family. Greg, if you want to ask about the spark of interest, really, my parents shared this spark with me. This trip through the life of Greg Kuperburg has become one of my most satisfying ventures into the world of vintage computing. I began my quest to validate my concept of the spark of technical curiosity, but the answer was always there, and I knew it. For me, the spark was an early Atari 800 and a stack of floppy disks. For Greg, it was a math professor household and an HP mainframe. For kids now, it might be Python and a Chromebook or something we haven't even discovered yet. What I go back to now is the photo of Kuperburg from 1980, the wide-eyed junior high schooler holding his own with the other college students at Auburn, discovering programming there, taking his first steps into the world of technology and his future. After taking this deep dive and conversing with Professor Kuperburg, I think what I see in that picture is not fleeting. He was just a kid, raising his hand to the world with an air of confidence, ready to take it on. It was the wake-up call of a computer game pioneer who had the mark of an auteur, but found his passion elsewhere. It's the jolt of true childhood wonder, captured in a single moment, betraying the future to come. The spark that will lead him to three early PC computer games, and then finding his true calling, a lifetime in mathematics. I hope you enjoyed this. Thank you for sitting all the way through. Please make sure to check out the full interview at the link in the show notes, or if you can scribble it down fast enough, right here on the screen now.
We were children of the Silicon Revolution, an X generation conscripted to fight the console and home computer wars. A product of an analog 70s childhood, we came of digital age in the 80s, believing we could affect the world 8 bits at a time. Armed with joysticks, full stroke keyboards, Jolt Cola, and MTV haircuts, we proceeded into the vertical blank. There, we stayed up late at night, devising incantations from D&D rulebooks and beginner's all-purpose symbolic instruction code. Video games were the match, and programming was the fuse, as the infinite possibilities of the digital world exploded into the internet age to come. We are Generation Atari.
Into the vertical blank.